Admiral Larkinreel 3.
Mainly missile specialists, and of course around the upper deck were various light arms. From the gun direction platform, I should explain, we were controlling our four CCAT missile systems, each with four rather ancient, quite serviceable missiles, and two Beaufort guns, which were each side of the bridge, old 40-60 Beauforts have been in the fleet for a long time. Disposed around the rest of the upper deck were various sailors and Royal Marines manning light arms, and various chief petty officers or NCOs and MCOs encouraging them and directing them. So I suppose I'm guessing there's 30 people on the upper deck. All the remaining 1,400 or so people in the ship were down below and couldn't hear what was going on or couldn't see what was going on. They could certainly hear. It was very much a visual affair, but very impressive. A lot of people were extremely young. A number of people had their 17th birthday, for instance, while we were out there. Very impressed. Young men don't seem to be troubled by this sort of thing. We'd worked them up to a high state of excellence. Our missile systems worked extremely well, ancient as they were. And the actual business of keeping a Beaufort gun firing successively round after round after round, a very skilled business. Requires coolness and good drill, and from our stuttering beginnings at Portland 6 months before, where we could barely get two rounds out of the gun before something went wrong, these two guns were just slogging away round after round after round. Very impressive. We always knew when attacks were coming, with two exceptions, so we were always well prepared. But the first attack, which I ought to have described, was a scene of great chaos. People hadn't settled down, guns going off in all directions, missiles whistling around. I certainly saw a missile passing down the side of the ship, which said to come from Intrepid, a sea cat. We were very extremely lucky not to inflict damage on ourselves or blue on blue, as it's called. And indeed, some days later, the one occasion when Fearless herself took some mild damage, I think it was probably from a 4.5-inch anti-aircraft shell from a friendly ship. We quite quickly settled down to a routine. Yes, we knew when the attacks were coming. We would always go to action stations well before daylight. We worked at the same time as the UK in terms of the clock, which saved a great deal of muddle. Fortuitously, things happened 4 hours later. We were in time zone, I'm going to write minus four, but anyway, to the west, which means things happen 4 hours later than the UK. So by keeping UK time, i.e. our clock said 4 in the morning, our clock said 8 in the morning, where it was really 4 in the morning by the clock. Oh gosh, I got that.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Yes, I have got it right. Good. So we were always at the same time as home, no problem getting time zones wrong. Also, we got up very early in the day, so we were able to get through some business, have a decent breakfast, and get the ship to action stations, and we settled down at action stations before first light, while the clock nevertheless set what seemed quite a civilized time. The Argentines, fortunately, were not good at fighting at night. Their air force, certainly, was our main concern, was not a nighttime air force. We had some worries about high-level Cameron bombers and the possibility they might conduct nighttime strategic or high-level bombing of the anchorage, but that never materialized, although it led us to do certain things which were, I think, sensible. So we settled down before first light, and then typically we'd find that the first attack would come in some 2 hours or so after that. As I said, we normally knew when it was coming. I would always, when the ship was settled at action stations first thing of the day, I would talk at length to the ship's at some length to the ship's company or everyone on board, telling them what I knew of the overall situation, to quite a high level of security. I suppose I was dealing regularly in information classified secret, but that seemed to me absolutely fine. I believe it's very important to keep people informed, and there didn't seem to be any way this information was going to be compromised. Certainly I was rewarded by the confidence that I felt the ship had in the management. This was remarked upon, I had their own style of doing this sort of thing. But whereas normally you don't speak to your ship's company very much, they seem to get bored with your voice. As we approached the theatre, they wanted to hear from me more and more, and I responded to that by talking to them as regularly as I could. When we got actually into the area of the anchorage where we were fighting what I was talking to myself, the Battle of San Carlos, they really couldn't hear enough from it. And from that initial broadcast earlier in the day, I would speak to them quite regularly in very informal terms. As the day went on, when we were expecting an attack, I'd say, well, we're expecting an attack of the assault force in about half an hour. Well, we'd be at action stations, relaxed, as it were. And then the thing was about 10 minutes away or so, I'd say, well, now going to area warning red, which meant that I would then hand over the commentary to the navigator who was on the bridge, and I would go up to the direction platform, where I would be up there, and people knew when I arrived on the gun direction platform, probably things were about to happen. And sure enough, they seemed to generally do so. It was an interesting business up there. One was very exposed and take protection. And having established the principle that I was going to be up there, it was clearly very important. I always was. And it was a curious sort of game, sort of quite one of the most unpleasant places to be in the ship, just when you knew it was going to get nasty. And I used to realize I was playing games with myself in a playful sort of way to see whether I could think of some rational reason for not sort of going up quite near. But I always did, it was very important that one did. And it was very important that one was extremely cool and composed, whatever was going on around one. And indeed, people responded to each other and to that extraordinarily well. And it was actually a pleasant place to be. I was glad to be there. It was all part of the team. And I wouldn't have been anywhere else in the world. People who couldn't see what was going on found it much more unpleasant. It was all very noisy. Yes, we kept people informed, but the bangs and pops and bollocks all occurred quite unexpectedly. Added to the fact that we were always concerned about the possibility of underwater attack in the anchorage, which was quite deep, and we were always chucking over these scare charges, £1 charges, £2 charges, which go into the water and explode. And although they make a terrific racket, and a steel ship with one of those going off alongside it, it's a tremendous riot. And people down in the ship, one did one's best to warn them and say, you know, scare charge being thrown over now, but sometimes there wasn't time to warn people, or if one of the drivers had gotten, but it was very unpleasant to be deep down in a ship. Perhaps there's not many other people in your particular compartment, and I had huge admiration for people in that position, and very conscious of the need to keep their spirits up and keep them in good heart, which I think we were very successful in doing. Everyone remarked what a good place to be if you had to be there. It wasn't a bad thing to be in fears, and I'll say that with great confidence and a lot of pride. We go through the day, and often the weather having been appalling or bad visibility the day before we came in, the day of the landing the weather was pretty good, and so were many subsequent days, and one would watch the sun moving unaccustomedly through the northern sky from right to left instead of the other way around, reminding one was in the southern hemisphere. And I always recall the great clarity of the atmosphere. And of course, we rather hope for bad weather, but of course the Argentines didn't do so well then. And then, when it got quite dark, we would go to a more relaxed routine. We'd go to what we call defence watches. It meant that we could send basically half the people away to sleep, to have a good meal, to sleep, and get on with the administration. And so the daily cycle would continue. So far as the actual sequence of the battle went, we were quite badly dusted up the first day. Again, I won't go into that in great detail, but some personal impressions are quite interesting. Antrim got quite badly damaged. She had been out. We had spread ships out in Falkland Sound quite broadly because we were genuinely concerned about the submarine threat. Again, we rather took our own standards. We thought that people trained to our standards of submarine expertise, using their small submarines, could get into Falkland Sound and operate there, although it wouldn't have been easy, perfectly possible. We thought the Argentines probably received German naval training in the Baltic, which is shallow. Excuse me, so this would have been perfectly feasible. So say we were concerned about the submarine threat, and that led us to spread ships around a bit, which was in turn directly responsible for some of the damage we sustained on the first day to Antrim, to Antelope, Argent, who was sunk, odd enough, the older ones, who were there? The Yarmouth, the mother elder ships, they got away unscathed. There were various gun lines to be manned as well, which meant providing a bombardment cover to the infantry, and particularly until the artillery got established ashore. I think our feeling for submarine threat became clear. There wasn't much activity going on, and we became very clear that the safest place to be was in what became an air defence bastion of San Carlos. To create that air defence bastion, we disposed ships. Finally, we concentrated ships using the principle of getting onto the land. We found that in San Carlos waters, that's what the southern arm of the whole water complex is called, I think it is. But we packed all the ships down there underneath a bluff of land, which wasn't that high, I think about 800 feet, but it was quite enough to disturb the aircraft. We packed them in very close, and well within, ships were much closer than they normally would be for peacetime swinging circles, when you would assume the worst case, ships will swing into each other if they swing in different directions on their anchors. Well, we put them much closer than that, and I perpetuated in a slightly Peter Sellers term, better a blump than a blomp, which seemed to be quite a good watchword. But actually, ships didn't seem to bump into each other very much. And by packing them underneath this bluff of land, and then putting the warships around outside them, we literally built a sort of hard enclave, which was very difficult for the Argentine aircraft to get at, and they had to go through a pretty serious line of fire to get there. We also had the Rapier Shore Defence Battery, which was disposed around the anchorage in positions we had worked out with some care. A Rapier was a new system, somewhat untried, and it also suffered from lack of use on the way down, so actually getting Rapier operational was quite a struggle. And actually, I have to say, I don't think it was quite as effective as even then, as we supposed at the time. It's been much improved since, the typical system, which hasn't really been tried in war. Often it turns out less fancy to anticipate. And well recorded, that was also the case with the Seawolf missile, and you can read about that extensively in Admiral Woodward's book. But we established, we discovered by experience what we could and couldn't do, where we were vulnerable, where we went, and it quickly became apparent once we settled down that within our air defence bastion we were very safe, and the Argentines really couldn't do very much to us after about the third day. Their successes after that were pretty much on the fringes, although far from contemptible for all that. We didn't like sending ships out unprotected out in Falkland Sound around the islands. We had a lot of things to do out and about. We always did these at night. So in saying that we broke down from action stations at night, it didn't mean we just sort of snuggled down in the anchorage. We did two things. First of all, we dispersed the ships from the position they'd been in during the day, the very tight formation. And again, I think this was somewhat I contributed to this thinking. We spread them around the anchorage. We were concerned the Argentines might have got a good feel for where they were. They sank very close to each other, and we definitely felt we would be vulnerable for high-level bombing attacks by Canberras, where they could run a stick of bombs along the line of ships and even die. So all the laws of coincidence achieve some damage. So we always moved the ships at night and reassembled the tight anchorage before daylight. So there's much to be done in running the anchorage, which was done from Phyllis. And also, we had many things to do in terms of landing special forces in convoy ships in and out. We never had more ships in the anchorage than we had to, for the particular bit of the unloading plan that we were engaged upon. Excuse me. And so, from the holding areas which Admiral Woodward established out to the northeast, we would be convoying ships in and out. Each night, almost every night, there was an outgoing convoy, an incoming convoy, and the escorts would change over to the halfway point, always trying to get the ships in before daylight. And the incoming ships in before daylight. So really, the warships, including Fearless and Intrepid, were pretty busy most nights, and the wet many nights, we spent swimming around anchor in the anchorage. We very much left the merchant ships there in devices and the logistic ships and right and about doing various things to push the operation forward. A huge aviation going on the whole time. All the helicopters we had, light and heavy, were active. Quite a problem drawing attacks. Before we settled down, I found that having helicopters in the vicinity of the ship drawing air attacks was difficult. We couldn't hear ourselves speak because of the noise of the helicopters, and I spent a lot of Thursday trying to persuade them that drawing an attack means go and take shelter in sort of fells and hills and that sort of thing until the attack was over, and this in turn considerably disrupted the unloading of the force. But that brings me on to that whole topic, really, because having got into the anchorage, you don't, of course, land a 5-battalion brigade by magic. It's a very lengthy undertaking. First of all, you get the troops ashore, the infantry ashore, and then this huge backup logistic effort and establishment of your logistic bases and all that sort of thing ashore. The first thing to be done during the first day was the five formations landed and took up positions. All well recorded, for instance, in Brigadier Thompson and General Vaux's, then Colonel Nick Vaux's book. They took up positions around the surrounding high ground, mainly on reverse slopes, which would protect the anchorage against a counterattack, which we expected to develop very rapidly from the Argentines. And that was followed up by the landing of the air defence batteries, the rapier in their establishment, landing the artillery. And then a huge process of landing logistics, ammunition, every sort of stores, establishing bases. One established at Ajax Bay on the west side of San Carlos Water by the old sheep processing plant, where we also established a field hospital. And, of course, all this depended on the operation of helicopters, the operation of landing craft, and what ship we had in the anchorage. And there was tremendous conflict of interests which had to be resolved as to which ships we wanted in when, how many ships we could afford to have in there, which we didn't want to expose more than we absolutely had to. And that, of course, meant that the business of landing took longer, and consolidation of the bridgehead took longer than we planned or wished or was expected in London, where there's tremendous impatience to get on with the campaign. And of course, we had our disasters, because whereas we got the hang of how to deal with the very gallant attacks by the Argentine Air Force quite quickly, we were continually being caught out one way or another. And of course, the very big catch out was the destruction of the Atlantic conveyor out in the task force, which was a tremendous setback logistically, because she had a large ship. And absolutely underlined the fears we had for Canberra, had the Canberra been hit with three formations on board. The Atlantic conveyor had on board large numbers of helicopters, Harriers, and all sorts of stores, including tentage and that sort of thing. Well, fortunately, we got the Sea Harriers off and embarked on Hermes and Invincible, but we hadn't disembarked the helicopters, and a large number of helicopters were lost in the Atlantic conveyor, and that in turn had a tremendous knock-on effect in the way that we conducted the land campaign. Because having got the landing force basically consolidated ashore and to a degree poised, was then the problem of how to move forward, which of course, to be done expeditiously, needs helicopters, which by this time had been lost. I think probably that's the best place to just pick up the story, because I was involved in a lot of these considerations, but I'll just go quickly over the military side. It became necessary to engage in the move forward on foot, which was possible because the paras and the commandos were so extremely fit. It was nevertheless a supreme achievement of sheer physical endurance, whereby we took what we could forward by helicopter, mainly guns and heavy stores, and a great deal of it was taken simply on foot by what people could carry on their backs. We took Mount Kent by coup de main with helicopters, established one formation up there, which gave us a position in the mountains at the approaches to Port Stanley. But really the bulk of three formations had to make their way forward on foot through very difficult country. This had a major bearing on what happened subsequently. There was the Battle of Goose Green, conducted by two para, very much under political pressure. A battle that we won with considerable difficulty, great heroism, lost, of course, the commanding officer. But it did, by showing that one UK infantry unit with very little support could actually get the better of a garrison of 1,400 Argentines or thereabouts, did actually underline indelibly to the Argentines the acute difficulty they were in. Having met Argentines since, it's become clear that they never anticipated, of course, a forceful attempt to regain the islands, and they were not disposed to resist a counter-invasion, and all their planning, whereas ours was difficult enough, at least we were practiced at planning together, they didn't have good inter-service cooperation, and their plans to defend the islands were very much extemporized, quite apart from their failure to read our campaign at all. Well, they didn't think we'd land at St. Carlos, they couldn't believe that we had crossed the islands on foot, or the west, the east islands on foot to invest at Port Stanley. So they were continually on the back foot. And the Battle of Goose Green and the surrender of the garrison there was a tremendous setback for them, which I think psychologically they never recovered. How did this affect us in the anchorage and the maritime support side? Once the land campaign was underway, we became a supporting operation, obviously intent on holding the beachhead and defending it, and all stores had to come in through us. And that was very much our prime responsibility to keep all that going. Now, at this time, we had the reinforcement brigade. So we had three commando brigade, which was three infantry formations, and three commando formations, two para formations. We were now to be joined by a scratch brigade, five infantry brigade, which had one Gurkha battalion, one Scots Guards, and one Welsh Guards battalion. Now, I won't get into the difference between that formation together. It came down in Queen Elizabeth. I think it's fair to say that apart from not being a coherent formation in the same way, that the commando brigade had been working together for a long time. I don't think that some of those formations took as seriously as the commandos and the paras the need to get themselves fit on the way down. And I think in their defence they expected mainly to be engaged in garrison duties around San Carlos to relieve the five spearhead formations, all of which were very battle ready to do the fighting. But for various reasons, it was decided that they should, after all, contribute to the forward force. A 40 commander, to their great disappointment, was therefore became the core garrison battalion at San Carlos, defending San Carlos from the land. And it was decided that the Welsh and Scots Guards and the Gurkhas should be sent forward. Well, they tried going on foot, like everyone else had done, and it quickly became clear that they really weren't fit enough to do this. And with our very limited helicopter resources, this posed very serious problems. We were beginning the commandos and paras, the three commando brigade. It was basically establishing itself ready for the push in the hills, and push forward to Fort Stanley. It was very important to get 5 infantry brigade in position at the southern sector to do its bit. And it was decided that we'd have to take them forward by sea. So, added to our night excursions was the need, and we're well into the beginning of June now, to take the Scots and the Welsh Guards forward by ship. And the ship's best fitted to do this was fellows of Intrepid. So Intrepid conducted the first such operation, which meant leaving San Carlos as soon as possible after darkness with the Scots Guards embarked. And with her four landing craft, she managed to get far enough forward around the bottom of the island of East Falkland, in Lofonia, which is the southern bit of the island, to send Major Ewan South Petalia and a four landing craft with the battalion embarked forward to Bluff Cove and Teal Inlet. Intrepid couldn't get that close, and they really had a very difficult passage in bad weather overnight. It's one of the sort of traumatic moments of the campaign for those involved. Very much Ewan South Petalia's determination and leadership and seamanship. And he, of course, was very, he knew the Falklands waters very well, got that formation forward and safely ashore, albeit after a very traumatic and unpleasant night in these open landing craft. Capitellis was the headquarters and had all communications for the land force, we decided that we'd have a go with the Welsh Guards the next night, which was not an easy thing to do, and indeed we did it once and decided it was really, from the point of view of keeping the force together, it was going to be too difficult to really repeat on that scale. But we did the same thing the next night with the Welsh Guards. Now, unfortunately, I had to leave two landing craft of my four behinds in San Carlos. That's a good landing craft. One had been slightly had been somewhat damaged. The other was needed for some vital unloading activities. So I only had two landing craft. And the idea was, or the plan was, that UNSS Battalion would rendezvous with the four Intrepid landing craft. I would then send out two of mine loaded with Welsh Guards. I'd take in Intrepid's four back, reload two of them, and send them out with the other half of the Welsh Guards, and then return to San Carlos with two of Intrepid's landing craft, leaving four forward in the Bluff Cove, Tilinidad area, where there's much for them to do. It was very bad weather, and there was a front coming through, and also our communications. I didn't have direct communications with the UNSS Battalion. And it really amounted to a tragedy of considerable dimensions, because we did get well forward. We got further forward than Intrepid by some margin off Lively Island. We knew there was an extemporised land-based Exocet battery probably on Cape Pembroke, south of Port Stanley. We knew we had to keep outside the footprint of that missile system. But that aside, we got fairly close to Bluff Cove. But unfortunately, UNSS Battalion, and I was by that time, the front was going through, and so actually the weather was quite passable where we were, where it was still terrible for UN, and with experiences of the previous night, he wasn't keen to set forth unless he knew things were in better shape than they had been, and I couldn't talk to him directly, so he didn't actually set out. So I had to dispatch two landing craft, which meant there were now six in the vicinity, Teal and Bluff, with half the Welsh Guards. I took the other half back to San Carlos. I'd waited too long, and we had a fairly uncomfortable passage up Falkland Sound in quite good daylight by this time, very exposed, but there was fortunately no attack, and we got into San Carlos unscathed. But still, with half the Welsh Guards embarked. Well, the rest of the story is quite well known, in that the next night we had some very complicated convoy evolution up to the north of the island that we had to take charge of, which involved another exposed return as it happened, because that was also marginal. The second night running, I found myself scuttling in to the north of the Falkland Sound in broad daylight, and we had some apprehension from the exit back here on Pebble Island, although in fact it was not. But meanwhile, we decided the only way to get the Welsh Guards forward in concert with the other things we had to do was into Galahad. So they were loaded on board Sir Galahad that day, and we directed her sailing the following night in time to get around, but she was late sailing for reasons which I don't entirely recall. And as well known, she and Sir Tristram, who went with her, were then found exposed by the Argentines in one of their last big efforts with their air force, and severely damaged next day. Indeed, Galahad terminally so, with lots of Welsh Guards still on board Galahad. I don't want to unravel that story again. It's been very well written up. Suffice to say, I think I would even take some personal responsibility with Mike Clapp for the fact that Sir Galahad was there